A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants to dig into libertarianism as a political philosophy. Not the bumper sticker version, but the real intellectual history. Three specific questions. First, how the movement first defined itself and decided it needed its own label. Second, how it got institutional footholds, the think tanks, the political vehicles. Third, who the most articulate advocates are today, the people making the case right now. And underneath all three is a bigger tension. How does libertarianism actually distinguish itself from centrist liberalism, from the kind of person who reads The Economist and calls it a day?
That last part is the key, because most people treat libertarian as a synonym for Republican who doesn't care what you smoke. And that's not just inaccurate, it misses the entire philosophical architecture underneath. The movement has its own internal debates, its own canon, its own intellectual fault lines that go back decades.
The history is genuinely surprising. Most people assume libertarianism is just American conservatism with a different haircut. But the word itself starts on the left. The first person to use libertarian as a political label was a French anarcho-communist named Joseph de Jacques in 1857. He wrote a letter to Pierre-Joseph Proudhon, the guy famous for saying property is theft, and de Jacques basically told him, "You're not radical enough, you're still too comfortable with the economic order." He called himself a libertarian to distinguish his position from Proudhon's mutualism.
Which is wild when you think about it. The term that now means taxation is theft was coined by someone who thought private property itself was the problem. De Jacques was an anarcho-communist. He wanted to abolish both the state and private property entirely. The word migrated across the political spectrum over about 100 years.
The migration wasn't organic. It was a deliberate rebranding. In 1955, an American writer named Dean Russell, he was a columnist for the Foundation for Economic Education, published a pamphlet called Who is a Libertarian? He argued that the term liberal had been captured by the New Deal state. In the 19th century, liberal meant free trade, limited government, individual rights. But by the 1950s in America, liberal meant social security, public works, the administrative state. Russell said, "We need a new word." And he proposed libertarian.
Russell's pamphlet is one of the most consequential pieces of political branding in the 20th century, and almost nobody reads it today. His argument was simple. Classical liberals had lost the semantic war. You couldn't say, "I'm a liberal" anymore without people thinking you supported FDR-style programs. So he reached back to a word that had been floating around European radical circles and gave it a new valence. And it stuck.
It stuck because there was a genuine intellectual movement forming that needed a name. This wasn't just a PR exercise. By the 1950s and 60s, you had a cluster of thinkers, economists, philosophers, legal scholars, who rejected the New Deal consensus, but also didn't fit comfortably in the conservative movement of the time. Buckley's National Review was anti-communist and pro-tradition, but it wasn't particularly interested in dismantling the state. These people were.
The central figure who gave the movement its intellectual architecture was F. His book, The Constitution of Liberty, published in 1960, is probably the most sophisticated defense of classical liberal principles written in the 20th century. Hayek argued for what he called a spontaneous order. The idea that complex social systems, especially markets, emerge from decentralized individual choices without central planning. His positive case was that this order works better than any designed system. His negative case was that central planning inevitably fails because no planner can possess all the dispersed knowledge in a society.
Here's where the internal tension starts. Hayek was not an anarchist. He believed the state had legitimate functions, courts, police, national defense, and even a minimal safety net. He specifically said he was not a libertarian, because to him that term implied a kind of rationalist dogmatism he rejected. He preferred old Whig or classical liberal.
and then you have Murray Rothbard. Rothbard is the figure who takes the libertarian label and runs with it to its logical extreme. His book, For a New Liberty, published in 1973, argues for anarcho-capitalism, the complete abolition of the state, with all services including law and defense provided by the free market. Rothbard grounded this in natural law theory. Individuals have absolute rights to their persons and property. Any initiation of force against those rights is illegitimate, and the state by definition initiates force through taxation and regulation. Therefore, the state is inherently criminal.
The non-aggression principle. It becomes the foundational ethical axiom of the whole movement. And the split between Hayek's monarchism, minimal state, and Rothbard's anarcho-capitalism, no state at all, is the defining internal debate that runs through everything that follows. Every think tank schism, every political campaign, every internet flame war traces back to this fork in the road.
It's worth pausing on why this debate matters for understanding the movement today. Because when someone says, "I'm a libertarian," you actually don't know which side of this split they're on unless you ask. A Hayekian libertarian is going to sound a lot like a centrist liberal who's read a lot of economics. They want markets, rule of law, limited government, but they're not fundamentally hostile to the state as an institution. A Rothbardian libertarian views the state as a criminal enterprise that should be abolished, full stop. Those are not the same position. They don't lead to the same policy conclusions, and they attract very different personalities.
The personalities thing matters more than most intellectual histories admit. Rothbard was a pugilist. He wanted a movement, not just a set of ideas. And in 1971, he got one. The Libertarian Party was founded in December of that year in Colorado Springs. Its first platform, in 1972, called for abolishing the IRS, ending the draft, repealing all drug laws, and withdrawing from all foreign military alliances. That platform is remarkable because it combined positions that appealed to neither major party. Anti-war leftists and anti-tax rightists had no natural political home, and the LP offered them one.
The 1972 platform is also where you see the fusionist strategy at work. The term came from Frank Meyer at National Review, but the LP applied it differently. The idea was, economic freedom and personal freedom are the same principle. You can't be for free markets, but against gay rights, or for drug legalization, but against free trade. The principle is consistent, and the LP was the first American party to say so explicitly. That consistency is still the movement's strongest rhetorical weapon, and its biggest electoral liability, because most voters are not philosophically consistent in that way.
The intellectual foundation gets laid, the party gets formed, but the real institutional muscle comes in the late 70s and early 80s. In 1977, Charles Koch, Ed Crane, and Murray Rothbard himself founded the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C. The name was deliberate. Cato's letters were 18th century essays that influenced the American Revolution, arguing against tyranny and for individual liberty. The Institute was originally Rothbardian in orientation, but within a few years, Rothbard was pushed out, and Cato shifted toward a more pragmatic, policy-focused approach.
This is one of those moments where the institutional history tells you more than the philosophy does. Cato's founding was funded by Charles Koch, who had made his money in oil and gas. Koch wasn't just a donor, he had a strategic vision. He wanted libertarian ideas to influence actual policy, not just circulate in academic journals. And that meant Cato had to be in Washington, had to hire people who could talk to congressional staffers, had to produce research that was useful to policymakers. The radical Rothbardian stuff, abolish the state entirely, was not going to get you meetings on the Hill.
Rothbard leaves or is pushed out, depending on whose account you read. And in 1982, he co-founds the Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama, with Lew Rockwell and Burton Blumert. The Mises Institute becomes the home for the more radical, more culturally conservative strain, what they eventually called paleolibertarianism. The Mises Institute doesn't want to be in Washington. It wants to be in Alabama, building a counter-establishment, training a new generation of Rothbardian economists and philosophers. It's explicitly anti-Washington, anti-establishment, anti-compromise.
This is the schism that defines the movement's institutional landscape for the next 40 years. Cato versus Mises. pragmatic beltway libertarianism versus radical paleo-libertarianism. You can see it play out on every major policy question. The Iraq War is a perfect example. Cato opposed the war on non-interventionist grounds. They published papers arguing it was strategically foolish and fiscally irresponsible. The Mises Institute also opposed the war, but their argument was different. It was imperial overreach, it was the warfare state expanding, and their tone was much more confrontational. Same conclusion. Completely different rhetorical and intellectual frameworks.
Then Ron Paul runs for president. His 1988 Libertarian Party campaign got about 430,000 votes, less than 0.5%. But his 2008 Republican primary campaign is where libertarian ideas really broke into the mainstream. He raised $35 million in a single quarter, mostly from small online donors. He got over 1.2 million votes in the Republican primaries. And the audience wasn't just economics nerds. It was young people, anti-war voters, people who were alienated from both parties. The Ron Paul Revolution was a genuine grassroots phenomenon.
What's interesting about Ron Paul is that he was a bridge figure. He came out of the Mises Institute world. Lou Rockwell was his longtime chief of staff. But he ran for office in the Republican Party, not the LP. And his son Rand Paul, who became a senator from Kentucky, continued that strategy. Rand Paul's filibuster over drone strikes in 2013, where he stood on the Senate floor for 13 hours, was a libertarian moment, questioning the state's power to kill its own citizens without due process. That's not a standard Republican position. That's straight out of the Rothbard playbook.
The movement now has ideas. It has institutions. It has elected officials. But the question Daniel's really asking is, who's making the case today? Who are the people a thoughtful listener should actually read or listen to if they want to understand libertarianism as a living philosophy, not a historical artifact?
I'd start with Michael Humer. He's a philosopher at the University of Colorado, and his 2013 book, The Problem of Political Authority, is, in my view, the most rigorous contemporary defense of philosophical anarchism. Humer's argument is not about economics, it's about political obligation. He asks a simple question, why do we think the state has the right to command us? And he systematically dismantles every standard answer. The social contract? We never signed it. Majority rule doesn't create moral authority. The evidence that the state produces better outcomes than alternative arrangements is surprisingly thin. His conclusion is that no state, democratic or otherwise, has legitimate authority over non-consenting individuals.
Humer is interesting because he's not a culture warrior. He is an analytic philosopher, writing in the tradition of people like Peter Singer and Derek Parfit. His arguments are careful, modest in tone, and unsettling if you take them seriously. He's not going to be on cable news yelling about the Fed. But if you want the intellectual steel man of the anarcho-capitalist position, he's the guy.
On the more moderate side, you have Jason Brennan at Georgetown. His 2012 book, Libertarianism, What Everyone Needs to Know, is probably the best single-volume introduction to the modern movement. Brennan is part of what's called the Bleeding Heart Libertarian School, libertarians who take social justice concerns seriously and argue that free markets actually help the poor more than the welfare state does. He engages with empirical social science. He's willing to acknowledge where libertarian orthodoxy gets things wrong, and he writes in a way that's accessible without being dumbed down.
Then there's The Critical History that came out just a few years ago. The Individualists by Matt Zwolinski and John Tomasi, published in 2023. This is the first comprehensive history of libertarianism, written by scholars who are broadly sympathetic, but not dogmatic. They trace the movement's intellectual roots, its institutional development, and its internal contradictions. They're willing to say, here's where the movement was inconsistent, here's where it was strategically foolish, here's where it failed to live up to its own principles. It's the kind of book that makes partisans uncomfortable, which is exactly why it's valuable.
Zwolinski is a good example of a newer generation of libertarian scholars who are trying to engage with the broader academic world rather than just talking to themselves. He runs the Bleeding Heart Libertarians blog, he publishes in mainstream philosophy journals, and he's willing to criticize the Koch network or the LP when they deserve it. That internal critical voice is something the movement has historically struggled with. The tendency toward purity spirals and excommunications is strong.
The online world is its own ecosystem. Reason magazine, which has been publishing since 1968, is probably the most consistent and accessible voice. Nick Gillespie and Catherine Mangu-Ward, the editors, are smart, funny, and heterodox. They'll criticize Republicans and Democrats with equal vigor. Reason's YouTube channel has been a surprising success, with millions of subscribers. They've figured out how to do libertarian journalism that doesn't feel like propaganda.
Then there's Tom Woods, who comes out of the Mises Institute tradition. His podcast is one of the most popular libertarian shows, and he's unapologetically Rothbardian. He's also a Catholic traditionalist, which puts him in the paleo-libertarian camp, economically radical, culturally conservative. That combination is increasingly influential on the populist right, and it's created some strange bedfellows in recent years.
That's actually the most interesting development in the last 5 or 6 years. The pandemic scrambled a lot of libertarian coalitions. Opposition to lockdowns, vaccine mandates, and tech platform censorship created alliances between libertarians and the populist right that would have been unthinkable a decade ago. You had people who spent their careers arguing for open borders suddenly finding common cause with Tucker Carlson on medical freedom. And on the flip side, a lot of left libertarians who were comfortable with the anti-war, anti-surveillance parts of the movement found themselves alienated by the Trump alliance.
The COVID period was a stress test for libertarian principles, and different parts of the movement responded very differently. The Cato Institute published papers arguing that lockdowns were an overreach, but also that vaccines were a public good. The Mises Institute was much more absolutist. Any state intervention was tyranny, full stop. And you saw the same split play out on social media in op-eds in the internal politics of the LP. The movement is still processing what happened.
Stepping back, if you're trying to distinguish a modern libertarian from a centrist liberal, what are the actual tells? I think there are three. First, the non-aggression principle as a hard moral boundary. A centrist liberal will weigh costs and benefits. Maybe this regulation does more good than harm. Maybe this tax is worth it for the social program it funds. A libertarian, especially a Rothbardian one, treats the initiation of force as categorically wrong. It's not a calculation, it's a prohibition.
Second, the default skepticism toward all state power. A centrist liberal tends to trust technocratic governance. The right experts, the right institutions, the right regulatory design can solve problems. A libertarian starting assumption is that state power will be abused, captured, or simply fail due to the knowledge problem Hayek identified. The burden of proof is always on the person who wants to use coercion.
Third, property rights is foundational. For a centrist liberal, equality of opportunity or equality of outcome is often the primary value, and property rights are instrumental. You protect them insofar as they serve those larger goals. For a libertarian, property rights are the foundation from which everything else derives. You own yourself, you own the fruits of your labor, and any collective claim on those fruits requires justification, not the other way around.
Those three distinctions are useful. They explain why a libertarian and a centrist liberal can look at the same policy, say, a universal basic income, and reach opposite conclusions even if they share the same empirical beliefs about its effects. The centrist liberal asks, does this reduce poverty? The libertarian asks, by what right do you take money from one person to give it to another regardless of the outcome?
That's why the movement is philosophically coherent, but politically difficult. Most people are intuitive consequentialists. They want to know if something works. The libertarian answer is, it doesn't matter if it works, it's wrong. That's a hard sell. But it's also why the movement has survived electoral defeats that would have killed a purely pragmatic political project. You can't vote away a moral principle.
The institutional ecosystem reinforces this. Cato, Mises, Reason, the Foundation for Economic Education, the Institute for Humane Studies, the Liberty Fund. These organizations create a parallel intellectual infrastructure. They fund scholarships, run summer seminars, publish journals, host conferences. A young person who gets interested in libertarian ideas can spend years moving through this ecosystem without ever encountering a serious intellectual challenge from outside it. That's both a strength, it builds deep commitment, and a weakness, it can produce insularity.
The question Daniel's prompt implicitly raises is, who's worth reading if you want to engage seriously without joining a cult? And I think the answer is the people who are willing to criticize their own side. Humer, Brennan, Swolinski. These are scholars who take libertarian principles seriously, but don't pretend the movement has all the answers. They're in dialogue with the broader academic world. They publish in mainstream journals. They change their minds when the evidence warrants it.
On the more popular level, Reason magazine really does do genuine journalism. They break stories, they investigate government abuses, they hold power to account regardless of which party holds it. That's the best of the libertarian tradition, the skepticism of concentrated power applied consistently. It's easy to be anti-establishment when the other team is in charge. It's harder when your own allies are running things, and Reason has been willing to criticize Republican administrations when other conservative outlets wouldn't.
Let's pull together what we've covered. The movement self-defined in the 1950s when Dean Russell and others realized they needed a new label after liberal was captured by the New Deal. The intellectual architecture was built by Hayek and Rothbard, who agreed on the diagnosis but split dramatically on the prescription, minimal state versus no state. The institutional footholds came through Cato and Mises, which represent the pragmatic and radical wings respectively. And today's most articulate advocates range from academic philosophers like Humer and Brennan to public intellectuals at Reason and the Mises Institute.
The through line is the non-aggression principle. Whether you're a minarchist or an anarcho-capitalist, whether you're reading Reason or listening to Tom Woods, the core claim is the same. Initiating force against another person or their property is wrong, and the state does this constantly. Everything else is downstream of that.
The practical takeaway for someone trying to navigate political arguments today is that libertarian ideas show up everywhere, often unacknowledged. When someone argues against vaccine mandates on the grounds of bodily autonomy, that's a libertarian argument. When someone argues against foreign military intervention on the grounds that it's not our business, that's a libertarian argument. When someone argues for cryptocurrency on the grounds that monetary policy shouldn't be controlled by unelected central bankers, that's a libertarian argument. Recognizing the framework helps you see what's actually at stake.
The framework also helps you spot when someone is using libertarian rhetoric selectively. A politician who talks about freedom from regulation but supports drug prohibition is not a libertarian. They're just a conservative who likes low taxes. The consistency is the tell. Real libertarians apply the non-aggression principle across the board, which is why they end up with policy positions that don't fit neatly into either party's platform.
The open question, and I think this is where Daniel's curiosity about the movement's future comes in, is whether libertarianism can survive its own success. As its ideas get absorbed into mainstream conservatism and liberalism, does the distinct identity dissolve? If Republicans are now skeptical of foreign intervention, and Democrats are now skeptical of surveillance, what's left that's uniquely libertarian?
I think the next frontier is digital governance. AI regulation, data property rights, algorithmic decision-making by governments. These are areas where the non-aggression principle faces entirely new challenges. What does it mean to initiate force against someone's digital property? What does consent look like in an age of ambient data collection? The 20th century libertarian framework was built around physical property and physical coercion. The 21st century is going to require a serious rethinking.
That's where the next generation of advocates will have to earn their keep. The old debates, gold standard versus fiat currency, the draft, the drug war, those have either been settled or rendered obsolete. The new ones are going to be weirder and harder. But the philosophical tools the movement built, the non-aggression principle, the knowledge problem, the skepticism of concentrated power. Those are useful for thinking about what comes next, even if you don't accept the full Rothbardian package.
If someone wants to dig deeper, the three books I'd point them to are Humer's, The Problem of Political Authority. For the philosophical case, Brennan's Libertarianism, What Everyone Needs to Know for the overview, and Swolinski and Tomasi's The Individualists for the critical history. That trio gives you the strongest version of the argument, the most accessible map of the terrain, and the most honest assessment of where the movement has succeeded and failed.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the 1930s, the Seychelles, then a British crown colony, had a population of approximately 28,000 people, of whom roughly 2,000 were registered descendants of the original French settlers who had been exiled there after losing a succession dispute over the French throne in the 18th century.
Right. The question of what comes next for libertarianism is open. The movement has outlasted predictions of its demise before, but the intellectual landscape is shifting, and the old coalitions are fraying. Whether the next generation builds something new or just keeps refighting the Hayek-Rothbard debate is going to depend on whether they can apply the principles to problems their predecessors never imagined.
This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps other people find the show.
We'll be back next week with whatever Daniel sends us.
Try not to initiate force against anyone in the meantime.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.